I have something to tell you. Your fix of post-punk, new wave, garage rock, and proto-punk? Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Hey, but don't tell anyone. I'm Izzy, and this is Our Secret.
My name is Jean Legault, Science 82, former CFRC alumnus, jazz director from 1980 to 1982. I'm thrilled to be back on campus. I can't describe how important CFRC was to me, not only as a training ground, it helped me develop my confidence in public speaking, and as far as my love of music, was developed directly from this station. The wealth of records back then, we didn't even have CDs, and the people, the terrific volunteers that were here. I want to thank CFRC, and I'm really pleased, and I'm amazed at the technology that's here, and I'm wishing you all the best of success. This is Jean Legault for CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Ellie MacArthur. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. We have a few messages directly from the city of Kingston this evening. To start us off, a reminder that the University District Safety Initiative remains in effect this week, running nightly through November 3rd. The initiative aims to keep celebrations safe and respectful in Kingston's University District during the busy fall season. Residents can expect to see increased police and bylaw presence, and anyone caught hosting or participating in a nuisance party could face penalties, up to $2,000 for hosting and $500 for failing to comply with orders to leave a property. The city says the program has been successful over the years in balancing celebration and safety. Kyle Compo, the city's director of licensing and enforcement, states, quote, "We encourage students and guests to avoid high-risk behaviors and reckless partying that could result in fines or put unnecessary strain on emergency services," end quote. Gord Edgar Downey Pier and Breakwater Park Beach will also be closed nightly from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. until November 2nd. The city of Kingston is paying tribute to Canada's veterans with an installation of two new veterans commemorative crosswalks at Lower Union and Ontario Streets. The crosswalks, featuring a stylized maple leaf and the image of a soldier, honor the service and sacrifice of those who stood on guard for Canada. Mayor Brian Patterson says Kingston is joining cities across the country in, quote, "honoring and paying tribute to veterans through painted pedestrian crosswalks that offer ongoing opportunities for reflection." An unveiling ceremony will take place on Wednesday, October 29th, from 9:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the site. Road closures will be in effect on Ontario and Lower Union Streets during the event. These crosswalks come ahead of several Remembrance Day events in Kingston, including the National Memorial to the Fallen unveiling on November 1st, Indigenous Veterans Day on November 8th, and the city's Civic Service of Remembrance on November 11th at McDonald Park. The city has announced that Homestead Land Holdings Limited will continue its naming rights for the Homestead Baby Grand Theater for another 3 years through to 2028. Homestead has been a longtime supporter of the Kingston Grand Theater, first partnering with the city during the 2004 restoration campaign that raised $3.35 million to revitalize the downtown venue. The Homestead Baby Grand Theater, located inside the Grand, is a smaller, more intimate space, known for its cozy atmosphere and close-up connection between artists and audience. Danica Lockhead, Director of Arts and Culture Services with the city, says, quote, "Homestead Land Holdings has been a dedicated supporter of the arts in Kingston for decades. Its continued partnership helps ensure the Homestead Baby Grand Theater remains a vibrant performing arts space for our community." This renewal comes alongside a $30,000 annual investment from the Britton Smith Foundation in the Grand Onstage School Performances Program, which helps local students experience live theater each year. The Toronto Blue Jays are in the middle of their World Series run, and the city of Kingston is keeping the excitement going downtown with free watch parties in Springer Market Square. The screenings kicked off last weekend and continue tonight and through the week, with each game being shown live on a big outdoor screen outside City Hall. Games start at 8 p.m. and the events are happening rain or shine, with updates posted by 6 p.m. on game days. Fans are encouraged to bring friends, blankets, and their Jays gear and help cheer Canada's team through the World Series. Once again, you can watch on the big screen in Springer Market Square starting at 8 p.m. tonight, October 27th, the 28th, 29th, and 31st, and November 1st. The City of Kingston is joining neighboring municipalities to explore more via rail service between Toronto and Kingston, including a possible late-night train. The initiative is part of a regional survey launched today by Kingston, Port Hope, Cobourg, and Belleville to gauge community interest in expanding passenger rail options. Mayor Brian Patterson states, quote, "Passenger rail is one of the key transportation options that keep Kingston and all Eastern Ontario communities connected." The survey will help determine whether there's enough demand to advocate for new service times. Residents have until November 17th to share their thoughts through the city's website. This new survey is the next step in a push that started right at City Hall. Kingston City Council called on Via Rail to not only preserve service to the city, but look at expanding it, including the idea of a late-night train back from Toronto. Here's a look back at that story.
Via Rail, get your act together.
That was Councillor Brandon Tozzo at Tuesday night's City Council meeting following an eventful few weeks for rail travel in southeastern Ontario. In September, to accommodate the launch of a new nonstop express train between Toronto and Montreal, Via Rail announced it would be reducing the number of trains stopping in Kingston and other municipalities along the corridor. However, the company postponed the planned service reduction shortly after the announcement. This all comes after changes announced in March to Via Rail's earlier high-frequency rail proposal, which originally included establishing Kingston as a regional hub. These changes were also formally opposed by council. Mayor Brian Patterson brought a motion to council on Tuesday night aimed at not only securing Kingston's current level of rail service, but also improving it. The motion includes three key requests to Via Rail. The first two are that Via Rail commit to maintaining existing passenger rail service levels in Kingston and commit to a forward-thinking plan for enhanced passenger rail service in Kingston, including upgrades to the existing station and predictable, improved service into and out of Kingston. Mayor Patterson elaborated on the reasoning behind the motion.
The purpose of this motion is twofold. Number one, I think it's important that we continue to work to preserve the level of service we have. And so to be clear, VIA has made it as intending to still move ahead with these changes, just not at this point. So I don't think that we can shrink back and be complacent about this. But the second piece is that even with the status quo, I don't think that we should be satisfied with that status quo. And I think we've had those discussions around this table. I've heard many of you talk with the same passion and sometimes frustration that I have on this issue, because I see so much potential for what rail service could be to and from Kingston. I feel like there's a failure of imagination, a failure of an ambitious vision for rail service that I think would very much have the potential to transform a lot of travel through Eastern Ontario.
The motion is topped off with an action item, a request to investigate adding a late night train from Toronto.
And I think if we're talking about where we can improve service, let's start with a very tangible, practical example. I hear all of the time from people in this community about how they would love to take a train to Toronto to see a Jays game or a Leafs game or a show or even good dinner or even a late meeting, and you simply cannot do that. The last train that departs back for Kingston, you have to be at the station by about 6 p.m. or shortly after. So one of the things that I think that there is tremendous opportunity for is a late evening train back from Toronto. So here's a great opportunity where we can grow VIA's ridership, we can improve train travel. And so what we've agreed is that we will do our part in surveying the community and trying to get input about those who would be interested in late evening train.
Councillor Don Amos, who seconded the motion, didn't hold back his frustration with Via Rail's recent decisions.
At the end of the day, VIA needs to really evaluate their business model, because if you look at your fourth largest station and you decide to not provide more service there, how badly do they really want to be in the customer service business and moving people across the country?
The motion received unanimous support from council, and so did the feeling of confusion and exasperation over the company's shifting plans.
Like, what is VIA Rail thinking? I have no idea tomorrow. Like, I'm going to just open up the news and just be like, what is VIA Rail doing? Are they just bypassing Kingston? Are they shutting down service and going bankrupt? I think the chaos that this has brought onto the community cannot be understated, because people don't know what services we're going to get a week from now, 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now. Imagine what rail service could be in Eastern Ontario. We're living between three large cities, and it is becoming incredibly inefficient to take rail service. You know, I've had my frustrations in the past with VIA Rail. I cannot think of more of a time where I am more confused by the message an organization is setting out from a communications perspective to the community and to Eastern Ontario. I'm sorry I sound infuriated. This is one of those times where I'm actually really mad at a Crown Corporation, not the first time, but where I'm just like I have no prediction of what's going on in the future.
A copy of the motion has also been sent to other municipalities that will be impacted by service reductions along the Montreal-Toronto corridor, including Port Hope, Cobourg, Belleville, Napanee, Gananoque, Brockville, and Cornwall.
We do need allies in this, but I think that if we can join forces and have a collective voice on this issue, then we can finally shift the conversation from cutting service to where we could actually add and improve service.
Councillor Connie Glenn added she would be bringing the motion forward to the Ontario caucus to get other municipalities involved. For now, Kingston's rail future remains on the tracks, but uncertain, as council, commuters, and neighbouring municipalities wait to see what VIA Rail's long-term plans have in store. Once again, that was a flashback to a story from earlier this month regarding Kingston's push for better rail service. You can head to the city's website at cityofkingston.ca to have your say on a possible Toronto-Kingston late-night train. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Henry Walker with your campus news for this week.
Thank you, Chris. This is Henry with CFRC's Campus Beat, bringing you Queen's Campus News. This past weekend just marked Queen's annual FOCO, that's Fake Homecoming. As with previous years, the FOCO weekend has been accompanied by the enforcement of the University District Safety Initiative, or UDSI, a collaborative program between the Kingston City Police, City of Kingston, and Queen's University. The initiative is designed to promote community safety and reduce disruptions in the University District during high traffic periods, such as homecoming, fake homecoming, St. Patrick's Day, Halloween, and many more. Under the UDSI, individuals in the university district charged with certain provincial and municipal offenses, such as public intoxication, noise violations, and those contained within the nuisance party bylaws, may have their information shared with Queen's University for possible review under the Student Code of Conduct. The city and university may enforce additional monetary penalties on individuals charged under the UDSI, such as an hourly fee of $90 for each police officer or firefighter responding to calls. The UDSI is in effect from October 17th, homecoming weekend, through November 2nd, Halloween weekend. For some around campus, the placement of Queen's Homecoming directly following the university's fall reading week leaves a lot to be desired. With many students out of the city during that time, the incentive to return for homecoming simply does not exist. Instead, some choose to celebrate the following weekend, a trend that's helped create what we may refer to as FOCO, or Fake Homecoming. This back-to-back period of parties and celebrations has, in effect, stretched the student social session through the second half of October, from homecoming right through to Halloween. For the university and the city of Kingston, that means an extended period of heightened activity and enforcement, thus providing us with the UDSI, or University District Safety Initiative, as well as many of the nuisance party bylaws that remain in place throughout much of the academic year. While these measures aim to prevent disruptive street parties, Some students feel that the scheduling of homecoming itself contributes to the issue. Having an event immediately after reading week leaves little time for students to return, prepare, and participate in official sanctioned homecoming activities, leading many to organize separate celebrations later, i.e. FOCO. Others argue that moving homecoming a week later could help boost attendance at sanctioned events and ease the pressure on both the student and the community. As October winds down and the academic year continues, this debate also moves forward. Is the back-to-back timing of Reading Week a homecoming schedule coincidence, or is it a catalyst of this growing fall party period? Again, this has been Henry Walker bringing you Queen's Campus News on CFRC's Campus Beat.
This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, October 27th, daytime high of 9 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud dropping down to 2 overnight. Tuesday, October 28th, a little warmer, 11 degrees with an overnight low of 2, mostly sunny conditions during the day. Wednesday, October 29th, another 11 degree day here in the city of Kingston, that same 2 degree overnight low, mostly cloudy conditions in the forecast. Thursday, October 30th, daytime high of 10 degrees with an overnight low of 6, mostly cloudy conditions. Friday, October 31st, Halloween, 61% chance of precipitation in the morning and afternoon, should clear up for trick-or-treating in the evening. Daytime high of 10 degrees, overnight low of 6, so bundle up if you're heading out with the little ones on the 31st. Saturday, November 1st, daytime high of 10, mostly sunny conditions. Sunday, November 2nd, daytime high of 10, mostly rainy conditions, 55% chance of precipitation. And then moving into the start of the first full week of November, Monday, November 3rd, daytime high of 11, overcast with rainy conditions, overnight low of 4 degrees. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. We begin with a quick reminder from Public Services and Procurement Canada that the LaSalle Causeway will be closed on Sunday, November 2nd from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. That is closed to all pedestrian and vehicle traffic. In terms of road closures, Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess and Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Brass Point Bridge is closed October 29th and 30th from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. each day for the replacement of bridge deck planks. Motorists are asked to plan their travel accordingly and to exercise caution in the area. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Kings Court Ave, concession to First Ave, is closed until November 21st for gas main installation. Ontario Street at Lower Union is closed October 27th at 8 p.m. to October 28th at 4 a.m. for the installation of commemorative crosswalks. Ontario Street at Lower Union is also closed October 29th from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. for the unveiling of commemorative crosswalks. Queen Street, King to Ontario, is closed October 28th from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. to complete asphalt restoration. Wellborn Avenue, Chelsea to Everett, is closed October 31st from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. for the Wicked Wellborn Block Party. And Victoria Street, Union to Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Ave, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Ave. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper, expect delays while a contractor completes construction of new sidewalk and road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage. Taylor Kidd Boulevard, Collins Bay to Coronation, expect delays beginning October 30th at 7 a.m. to November 7th at 7 p.m. for the replacement of two culverts. Trudell Road, development to Danbury, expect delays while a contractor completes road and sidewalk improvements. And Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
This is Christina Laurie coming back in with your concerts and events calendars for this week. Tonight, if you're feeling competitive, grab a pint and some friends for trivia night at Something in the Water Brewing starting at 8 p.m. If live music's more your speed, head to the Cove Inn for John McClurg at 4 p.m. Or catch Two Voices in Jazz featuring Chantel Thompson and Natalie Cran at the RCAJ Club starting at 5:30 p.m. On Tuesday, October 28th, the Kingston Public Market runs all day in Springer Market Square. Visit local vendors and artisans from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. In the evening, it's Tom's Tuesday Happy Hour Jam at the RCHA from 4 p.m., followed by Shane Pendergast at the Cove Inn at 5 p.m. You can also stop by Timeout Bar for Paula Wood and Friends at 6 p.m., or head to Jersey Sports Bar for Open Mic Night with Carrick McAllister at 7 p.m. And for something heavier, The Exploited and Random Killing hit the Mansion at 8 p.m. On Wednesday, October 29th, catch Daniel Adam and Gary Barrett performing a lunchtime set at the Social YGK or Viento South, bringing Winnipeg Latin folk music to 109 Aldergrove Place at 5:30 p.m. Later on, Frank Ryan plays Musiki Cafe at 8 p.m. Christopher Jackson is at the Creekside Bar and Grill at 6 p.m. And Foreigner with 5440 take the stage at Slush Puppy Place at 7:30 p.m. If you'd rather take the mic yourself, there are open mics at Hotel Wolf Island and the Cove Inn, plus karaoke at Jersey's, the Mansion, and Time Out Bar throughout the evening. That's what's happening around town for the first half of this week. Be sure to tune in at the same time on Wednesday to catch your events and concerts for the rest of the week. Have a concert or event you'd like to add to our online and on-air calendars? Send details our way through cfrc.ca. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at cfrcmusic. Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by your friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present a single from Westport-based artist Resonant Transitions, a.k.a. Ken Little's debut album, Hearken Organum. The new album was recorded at the Spire and captures Ken's unique composition and playing style, bringing new sounds with cymbals, gongs, and percussion instruments. Stay tuned for tickets to Ken's album release concert taking place at the Spire on November 16th. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Hearken Organum now on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Rejoinder here with us on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Queen's Gaels are making the long trek to Windsor to battle the Lancers for a shot at the Yates Cup. These two teams last met on homecoming, where Windsor stole a victory on a last-second field goal. Can Queens avenge their homecoming loss, or will they suffer another agonizing semifinal stumble? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM to find out. We go live at 12:45 with the Grad Club pregame show and the scheduled 1 p.m. kickoff.
Good afternoon. My name is Bruce Swan. I graduated in Commerce 72. And I'm back after 53 years of being away from Queens. And I'm listening to CFRC. And when I was at Queens, I listened to CFRC. And so I'm glad to be here.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 288. Thanks for tuning in. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Nalini Mohabir, who is a writer, educator, and the co-author of The Fire That Time. Nalini teaches at Concordia University in Montreal, and I have gotten to know about Nalini's work over the last years. And this particular project, The Fire That Time, I think is really important to talk about right now. It is a book that looks into the anti-racist movement of students at Concordia University, then the Sir George Williams, where Black students and their allies rose up against systemic racism at Concordia University in the late 1960s. That led to a series of demonstrations and actions and what would become known in Quebec, Montreal, and in Canada as the Sir George Williams Affair. Outside of short news reports, The Fire That Time is a book that I think delves deeply into this event and all the political, social, cultural context around it, which is very important. This also is a book that looks at the repression that student activists faced, and it's particularly important and meaningful to think about that in the context of the repression we're seeing today of Palestinian students and also students involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement by university administrations in Montreal and beyond. So here's my conversation with Nalini Mohabir about the book that she co-authored, The Fire That Time.
So the name of the book is The Fire That Time. And you've collected, Nalini, these writings and essays, also documents and some photos that speak to a very important event of radical anti-racist student organizing here in Montreal, Jiajiage, Munyang, but also, of course, not just students. Often it's called the Sir George Williams Affair, but of course it spoke to a broader movement of Caribbean and Black consciousness and organizing here in Quebec, and of course, as connected to North America and, of most importantly, also the Caribbean. I found the project striking in the sense that it's such an important tool for now, you know, in the present. You know, there's so much discussion about student activism, and that's a very important focus point. But often in the media, student activism is talked about in kind of in time capsules or like vacuums that don't have any historical context. And I feel like this work is maybe a really important one to focus on right now because of this moment of student organizing, particularly around Palestine, but about these questions of institutional racism, these questions of power in the university. Maybe you could just first start by introducing yourself and just giving us a brief outline of the fire that time and the project.
Thank you so much for offering me this opportunity to reflect on the book project. It was something... So first of all, my name's Nalini Mahabir. I'm an associate professor at Concordia, but sorry, I hesitate because that doesn't feel like my primary identity and always feels kind of weird to say that. I'm somebody with Caribbean heritage and somebody who comes out of an activist organizing community mobilizing background before academia, and hopefully it's something I carry with me into academia. As you said, the book is tries to capture that spirit of transnational organizing that was happening in the 1960s. I should say, though, it wasn't me alone who collected those stories. So I have a co-editor, Ronald Cummings, who's at McMaster University. But really, it's so much bigger than the two of us. It was a collaborative effort as we've tried to reflect in the book with those who were present in 1969, with activists in... the Caribbean, as well as in Montreal, with young people and older people across generations. In terms of the structure of the book, we tried to reflect the way this moment starts in what might be seen as a kind of small microcosm of Montreal, which is the ninth floor of then Sir George Williams University, but really ripples out, beyond Montreal to Toronto, across the border into the U.S., and over to the U.K., France, and the Caribbean. So the first half of the book, it's focused on Montreal, and the second half on that transnational ripple effects.
When you say transnational, I could take a stab at trying to define that, but it'd be cool to also just hear from you, like, what does that mean for you? And also why thinking about politics through that lens of transnational frameworks is important now.
Thank you for calling me out on jargon. By transnational, all I mean is, at the most basic, is, across nations. So when something happens in one nation, like transnational migration, for example, means when somebody might migrate to one nation but might have investments still in their home country, and so they have a transnational relationship. So transnational organizing, we mean when a protest might happen in one country but then is connected to another. So, for example, in 1969, we have the Sir George Williams occupation in Montreal. Then in 1970, we have students in Trinidad and Tobago protesting in support of the students here in Montreal. And then their protests in Trinidad and Tobago kicks off the Black Power Revolution in Trinidad and Tobago. So that's one instance. Another instance in which I might call this transnational is that the year before, one of the questions that we might have is, is this a protest or is this a part of a movement, right? And what's the difference? But, I think of a protest as sort of more a one-off, but a movement is that difficult work of, sustaining a political engagement, analysis, struggle over, a longer period of time. So in 1968 in Montreal, we have the Congress of Black Writers, which precedes the Sir George Williams occupation, where we have a number of thinkers, activists, scholars from the Caribbean converging on Montreal. One of them is Walter Rodney, who was teaching in Jamaica at the time, and he was... he had a practice which at Concordia they use the term University of the Streets. In Jamaica, Walter Rodney would call that groundings, where he took the university beyond the campus to places like Trenchtown and reasoned with Rastas about, you know, what does a Marxist critique mean for their lives in Jamaica. So in doing so, he was seen as a threat to the conservative government in power at the time in Jamaica. So when he came to Montreal, he was actually banned from returning to Jamaica. So his being here and sharing these ideas of groundings and what it means to be a university beyond the campus, a university of the streets, to ground with people in the communities is another way in which we might see, you know, a transnational circulation of ideas, because after Canada, then he moves back to Guyana. So we see these figures at the time moving across spaces, connecting with each other as part of a Caribbean diaspora, even though they weren't all necessarily living in Montreal.
And so back to the fire that time. So for people who are hearing this and might not have heard about the Sir George Williams affair, so this is in downtown Montreal at Concordia University. It's maybe an event, but it's of course in this context you're talking about. What are like a few key points that you would think are important to communicate today about this event, and also how it relates to your book project?
I think, you know, in this moment where we see daily just people lining up for food and dying in front of the cameras, and, you know, our government's turning away and ignoring and in fact being complicit in a genocide that's happening, and to see students who've stood up in protest, who've developed encampments in solidarity with Palestinians, being targeted, international students in particular being threatened with deportation. I think it's really important for us to turn back to this moment in 1969 to understand at least what's happening in the Canadian context, where often we as Canadians tend to look across the border to the U.S. In this moment, like looking at Trump, for example, and think like, oh, what's happening there could never happen here. But in 69, those were international students from the Caribbean who were in Canada maybe no more than at the most 5 years, who were being discriminated against, who when they went through the proper channels of the university, proper in quotes, to complain, their complaints were ignored by the administration. So to stand up and hold what is the costliest student protest in Canadian history, in terms, which is often the way it's framed. There was approximately $2 million of damage to computers in the aftermath, blamed on the students, although debatable whether they were at fault. But it's also the largest protest against racism in Canada to happen on a university campus. And so they took great risks in you know, making sure that, you know, their voices were heard, that their complaints did not go unnoticed, that their concerns were heard not just by the administration, but, you know, again, heard in the Caribbean, which counters this idea of Canada being a benevolent kind of, you know, soft power that wants to create spaces of education and dialogue for students in the global south, when maybe the reality, or not maybe, the reality is much more extractive, which these students were trying to point out. And for that, you know, their moment of protest went all the way up to Canadian Parliament, where politicians debated deportations at that time, and where when the students were arrested after the university administration called the Montreal police on them, and the police as documented by the students themselves, beat or even tortured some of the students in that process of arresting them. And they, what makes that moment in particular so powerful was that it was a moment of anti-colonial international protests. So we see international student movements around the world that were trying to, you know, seek liberation. So in this case, although the Canadian government threatened them with deportation, the newly liberated Trinidadian government, which had gained independence from Britain in 1962, so only, you know, 7 years prior, paid the bail money for those students so that they could be out, which means then that their ambassadors supported international students studying abroad and did not see protest as something to be frowned upon or something to be stamped out, but actually was understood by the government as to why it's necessary in countries such as Canada.
You talked about this being one of the most, well, actually the most significant anti-racist protest led by students. I think in the contemporary context, it's not often articulated. I mean, of course, in some circles it is, of this, the racism and the systemic racism that's playing out today in terms of how Palestinian solidarity protests and particularly student leaders, racialized student leaders, are treated. So that what's happening now is not happening in a vacuum, right? And I think your work and this book speaks to that sort of trajectory of, is like, colonially, you know, systemic racism informed by colonial infrastructures ideologically and power-wise, in regards to power. Could you talk a bit about that? Like, the sort of, like, that moment of anti-racist action, the critical issues highlighted at that time, and also today, and why understanding the repression against Palestine activism from a lens of anti-racism is important.
I think it's so important because, obviously, you know, if what is happening, like, obviously is happening within a colonial context, well, you know, what's bound up in that? It's racism, right? Racism and colonialism go hand in hand. So if we think about the 1969 moment, well, I guess I would turn to an essay Sylvia Winter, the Jamaican scholar, wrote in relation to the Rodney King riots, where she is highlighting the way the media reported the protests that occurred in the so-called Rodney King riots, framed it as people who were the conceptual other, who were not North American, North American being defined as white, law and order, rule-abiding peoples, the so-called rational, as opposed to the irrational, non-human, colonial subject, conceptual other. So, to, you know, we definitely saw that playing out in 1969, where the students who were who had organized and taken over the computer center because strategically they felt that the university would not attack them in this space where valuable equipment was, were deemed to be having a computer party by one journalist, Dorothy Eber, for example, sort of framing it as, you know, an irrational act. And so when we turn to this present moment, I guess what I would turn to and who I always turn to, because I find her writing so profound and helps me think through so much that's happening in the present, is Dionne Brand, A Map to the Door of No Return, where she describes this moment where King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain had funded the Reconquista of Granada, so the Arab Spain, and then took that money that they got from expelling Muslims and Jewish people from Spain and funded Columbus's journey across the ocean to colonize the Americas. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand, one, that these movements are all connected, and two, that there has been a long, even before 1492, right, with the Crusades, such a long history of hatred against Muslims that I think, you know, we can see... you know, the way if we think about the conceptual other, we have to be conscious of the way people have been framed. You know, myself as somebody who looks South Asian, although it's not a term I would use to describe myself, you know, might be seen as a kind of model minority or whatever those stereotypes are, or passive or docile around being Asian, whereas I think Muslims and are seen as being radical, not radical as in a radical social justice activist, but radical as in dangerous. And we see that playing out when people come together to claim space and to protest.
The moment we're in right now, you can see the contradictions in the expression of liberal institutions around sort of claiming an anti-racist mantle and sort of like inclusion and diversity discourse, totally not matching up with what is actually happening in terms of military, state, corporate policy. Especially, you know, Trump has really taken the decorations off in a way, like of a lot of these institutions. And I feel like the last couple years in Western universities, we've seen that same thing, whereas like there's this discourse of universities being anti-racist spaces and inclusive spaces, etc. But then at the same time, you have this repression going on that is informed by everything you're talking about, right? And so in a way, it's like 1969 never ended, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for most people who come from colonized countries, identify as colonial subjects, identify with, although it sounds cliche, with the idea that the past is not past, mm-hmm. that we're still living in the colonial present, and we can see the way colonial powers organize our lives every single day. It's just mm-hmm. all around us. I completely agree with you about the way universities and other institutions and agents of the state use those terms such as diversity and inclusion. I feel very skeptical of them myself, because I do think it's a kind of corporate management tool or a way to, as Sarah Ahmed says, to, you know, to file a complaint and then file it away so that it looks like one is doing something but nothing is being done. Yet, I find myself in this odd, you know, contradiction where I feel I also have to defend it, because with everything that's happening south of the Canadian border, in terms of, you know, getting rid of critical ethnic studies, you know, black studies, anything with any kind of radical subjectivity to it, that it's... You know, it might be this idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion is the only mechanism that we have mm-hmm. within these institutions to have a presence. Mm-hmm. Although it's not a radical mm-hmm. approach, mm-hmm. it's maybe the only strategy left. So I feel the need to defend it.
That's a very haunting and important point for the present moment. Back to your the collective project that you worked on, the fire that time, maybe just to end, are there like a few pieces that come to your mind after having this discussion that like you're like, oh, like that's a really cool piece from the collection that I'd like to highlight to speak to so people can check it out?
I honestly, in all honesty, have to say that I think every piece is a cool piece, so that's a hard question for me to answer. Okay. But I think, like, coming back, I guess in this present moment, you know, if we think about why this history is important, mm-hmm. I think it's important to think about it not as a history that ended. And there's many ways in which we can see that. But one of the ways in which I'd like to highlight is two chapters on newspapers. One is Ronald Cummings' chapter in the student newspapers in Jamaica, and the other is Dorothy Williams' chapter on black community newspapers in Montreal. Because what that points us to is the ways in which after the protest, sort of the 2 weeks of occupation ended with a mysterious fire that was set by someone. There's not been an inquiry, an official inquiry, so we don't have evidence as to who set the fire. The students were accused of that, but they did, you know, they vehemently deny that and have other alternative theories. Following that, they were arrested, some deported, some lives changed forever, but they never stopped speaking about this moment. And they, the students at Sir George, both black and white, they had used the organ of the Georgian, the student newspaper at the time, to express their views. The offices of that student newspaper were raided by the RCMP, but they created alternative newspapers that circulated kind of like zines at the time. Then they went on to, some students went on to create Uhuru, which was a, one of the most important black community newspapers in Montreal.
That lasted for a long time,
that had critiques of funding, nonprofits, the Peace Corps activists going to supposedly to help the Caribbean, but who they identified as agents of the CIA. I mean, such important information, and again, transnational, to use that word, information that circulated in these seemingly local newspapers, but never local. That is how we build a movement. I mean, that's one of the aspects in which we can learn how to build a movement, is to not let the issue drop, to continue to make sure that there's, we have means to get our voices heard and to people, you know, who want to engage with this.
Thanks, Nalini.
Well, thank you, Stefan. Thanks.
That was a conversation with Nalini Mohabir, the co-author of The Fire That Time. Look it up. It's a very important collective title looking at the anti-racist student movements in Montreal, particularly at Concordia University, but also beyond, in the late 1960s. Thanks so much to Nalini for being on the program this week. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search for Free City Radio through your preferred podcast platform. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.